Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some things that the Lord has been doing in Mozambique and in our family, and I think I'll try to move through this as quickly as I can so that we don't stay here too awfully long. But I do want to say, and a lot of you who've heard me talk before realize that this is true for me, one of my favorite verses in missions actually comes from the Old Testament, and it's 1 Chronicles 16:24-25, and that's been on all of our publications from the very beginning. And it says, "Tell of his glory among the nations, his wonderful deeds among all the peoples, for great is the Lord and greatly to be praised." And our motive for being involved in missions always has been this desire to see God worshiped and glorified throughout the world as he ought to be, but especially in places in the world where he's hardly known or adored or worshiped at all. And I think that if there's any motive that ought to propel a Christian into mission work once he's come to know something of the greatness and the goodness of his God, it ought to be to hear the terrible report that there's a place out there where people do not worship God, a place where God is being robbed of the glory that's due his name, a dead and blackened spot upon the face of the globe from which no praise ascends. And that's always been what has driven us to be involved in missions, and that's the motive of that's mentioned in 1 Chronicles 16:24-25. But that verse also talks a little bit about the method of how to raise up people who are enraptured with their God. And interestingly enough, it's not so much pointing out to them how useful God can be to us as weak and sinful men, even though that's what we are and we very much need him. But it is by declaring the very glorious attributes of his person and his mighty deeds. And so that's what we seek to do in Mozambique, in raising up men and women who are enraptured with their God. We talk about his mighty deeds that he has done to glorify his name. And then when we come home on furlough, we have the same opportunity to talk again about the Lord's mighty deeds, this time to the saints at home, as we relate the things that God has been doing through your prayers and raising up a people for his own possession in Mozambique. And that's what I want to do tonight, and I'm trying to scan the audience to see how many people are relatively new. I think there are some people here. I'd like to bring you up to date, first on the field of Mozambique, and then how the Lord called us to that country. And then after that, I want to develop how the Lord has led our missionary work in Mozambique along three distinct lines. During our three terms on the field, the very first term, we were mainly involved in medical evangelistic work through a government hospital. And then in the second term, the Lord gave us a church planting opportunity as well, as a church was established there and registered in that country that we're associated with. And then in the third term, we joined forces with a Brazilian publishing house. They produce excellent Christian literature. And we joined in with them in order to be involved in a literature distribution program for pastors and church workers throughout the entire country of Mozambique. We've opened a bookshop in the city of Nampula where we work, and also have been hosting annual pastors' conferences for training pastors and church workers. And those have been attended by up to 160 pastors and church workers, come from 8 of Mozambique's 10 provinces, and representing 43 different church groups, denominations, and parachurch groups in Mozambique. So those are the three areas in which the ministry has developed over the years. I want to tell you a little bit about the field of Mozambique. It's a country in southeastern Africa. It's got 18 million Mozambicans living there. They come from 22 different tribal groups. It was a Portuguese colony until 1975, at which time the government was handed over to Marxist liberation fighters. And at that point, only 5 to 10% of the actual Africans were literate. They were very poorly equipped to take over their own country. And that, coupled with the sudden imposition of disastrous Marxist economic policies, the flight of all of the colonists who represented pretty much the entire technical infrastructure of the country, and then a civil war that went on for 17 years after that, they all combined to make Mozambique the poorest country in the world for 15 years running, and the nation with the highest level of human suffering anywhere in the world. And that was the mission field that we entered 14 years ago when we were sent to Mozambique by Grace Missions. The Civil War was still going on. We couldn't leave the city of Nampula where we were working except by plane because of the war that was raging in the countryside. The hospital where I was working, about 5 miles outside of town, was attacked 4 times in our first 2 years there. And all of these things made for fascinating missionary stories and remarkable accounts of God's wonderful deliverances. But that all pertains to the first term, so I'm not going to go through those things this evening. But I did bring to Nashville, and forgot to bring here tonight, old newsletters. If you're interested in some of those interesting stories, I'll try to have them available tomorrow at church. And they'll be on the back table here, and also some of our current evangelists, so you can look at that if you're interested. We're also getting a website up and running. It's gracemissionsministries.org, and we're putting all of those old evangelists, those old stories on there, so if somebody were interested, you could click on those stories and read them that way. It's not quite up and running yet, but we're working on it. Well, in 1992, the Lord answered a lot of prayers. The government decided to drop Marxism. They adopted a new constitution, which allowed for a democratic form of government. That brought an end to the Civil War, and it also established a free market economy. And at that point, the nations around the world began funneling millions of dollars worth of AIDS into Mozambique. And the economy has been, in the last 10 years, about the strongest economy in the continent of Africa. It's also been about the most stable country. And there is a rapidly emerging, educated middle class that we're working with in Mozambique. But the peasants themselves still remain among the poorest people in the world, with a per capita income of $120 a year. With regard to the spiritual climate in Mozambique, about 15% of the people say that they are Muslims, 15% would say that they're Catholics, and 10% say that they are Protestant evangelicals. But really, about 100%, it seems like, of the people are animists, and animism is the traditional African religion. They believe that the spirits of departed ancestors are still actively involved in the affairs of everyday life. Anything disastrous or bad that happens to them is attributed to these departed ancestors. The witch doctors are the priesthood that you go through in order to find out what to do to deal with these spirits, and they're a very prominent part in Mozambican culture. And even though 40% of the population does say that they are adhering to Western religions or to other non-African religions, really the vast majority of them still seem to resort to the witch doctors when problems arise. And that's even true to some extent in the Christian evangelical churches. And one of the reasons for the weakness of the churches is because of a lack of Bible instruction. During the Portuguese reign, because of the heavy Catholic influence, the Protestant churches were very much oppressed, and it got even worse in 1975 under the Marxist. But thankfully, since 1992, the Mozambican church has enjoyed freedom, and missionaries have been able to come back into the country. Bible schools are being established. There's a real interest in knowing the truth of God's word. The doors are open in Mozambique as they've never been in its history for missionary involvement. And so we're very thankful that the Lord has led us to that country. Now, with regard to our own involvement in Mozambique, the Lord began leading me there back in 1985. That was 11 years after he'd given me a clear call to serve him in the area of missions. But in 1985, he began leading through a number of remarkable circumstances that clearly bore his signature, pointing my attention to Mozambique. And when I began to study the country, already thinking it looks like the Lord is pointing me in this direction, I found out that it had three characteristics that made it especially an appropriate country for medical missionaries to work in. And the first one was that it was a legitimate mission field. Even though there was a Protestant church in Mozambique, they very much needed help from the outside Christian world in evangelizing their own country. And then the second thing was that it was a place where regular church planting missionaries could not easily go because of the Marxist government still in power in 1985. It was very difficult to get visas. There were very few regular church planting missionaries. However, they were very happy. They were eager for me to go because they viewed me as a very much needed medical doctor. Mozambique's only got, at that time, there were only two countries in the world that had fewer doctors per capita. So they were eager for me to go. because they saw me as a doctor and not as a church planting missionary. And then the third thing was that Grace Missions could set up a medical ministry there that would equal or surpass what was already available in the country without having to spend a lot of money, because, as I mentioned, they didn't have any medical care in that country. And so we could go and administer medical care without having to bring CT scans and MRIs and things like that along with us. And what was remarkable about those three characteristics was that the Lord had brought those things to my attention long before I'd ever heard of Mozambique. The idea had occurred to me, these are three criteria that would characterize an excellent mission field for a medical missionary. Now, I never presumed that the Lord would use those three criteria to lead me to a mission field. But when I found out about Mozambique and checked it out and saw that it matched those perfectly, then I was confident that the Lord had given me those ideas, those thoughts, as well as had been involved in directing our steps to that country. And so in 1987, I finished my time with the U.S. Air Force. In 1988, the Lord graciously gave me a wife in Julie Botter, who is been an excellent low-maintenance missionary wife for 14 years. And in 1989, we went off to language school, and in 1990, we finally were in Mozambique. We were working in Nampula, the third largest city of the country, with a population of about 500,000 people. And it's the cultural and the economic hub of the northern third of Mozambique, which is the most heavily populated part of the country. So it was a very strategic place to be assigned by the Mozambique government. I was supposed to work in the downtown city hospital. That was a very depressing place. Dr. Foster mentioned a little bit about the Angola hospitals. Mozambique was the same situation. They were very poorly staffed. There might be 10 doctors in this hospital, maybe 600 beds. And besides being understaffed, they had very little to work with. The operating room was usually closed down except for emergency procedures to save life or limb because of lack of supplies. The doctors would do major operations on people and only have aspirin afterwards to give the patients for pain relief. They'd have to operate on the colon without the benefit of antibiotic coverage, which meant that a lot of your patients would get infected and die. Because of the circumstances, patients were admitted to the hospital, basically just laid in their beds, unattended to and untreated, until they either got better on their own or they died. And so, as you can imagine, for somebody accustomed to Western standards to work in a hospital like that would have been professional and emotional suicide. But thankfully, we praise the Lord that He knew all of that and He was leading, because the day I showed up at that hospital to begin working, they informed me that they had changed my assignment, that a Canadian relief organization had come in and they had refurbished a beautiful, formerly beautiful hospital on the outskirts of town. And they had fixed it all up and they had provided a Canadian family practitioner to work there. And that organization had asked that the government provide them with a surgeon. Between a family practitioner and a surgeon, they could do everything Dr. Foster does by himself. And so when I showed up, because I spoke English, they said, "We want you to go out there." And the provincial health director took me to the hospital, and all they had was an empty surgical suite, had a little pan with a few broken instruments in it. And he said, "We'd like Grace Missions to try to outfit the surgical block, and you train the people to help out and then start doing surgery here." Well, he had no idea when he proposed that the Grace Missions already had a 20-foot sea container filled with everything you needed to completely outfit a surgical block, and it was already on the way across the ocean coming to Mozambique. And we, for our part, never knew. That wasn't the assignment that we were preparing for. That wasn't what we were expecting, but God provided all of that because He determines the end from the beginning and works all things after the counsel of His own will. And He worked right through our mutual ignorance without any problem and provided a wonderful opportunity for me to work in that hospital after the Canadian government had totally refurbished it for us. Well, after a few months, the Canadian organization decided they didn't want to be involved in health anymore. They sent their doctor home, and I became the only doctor working in that hospital. And pretty soon, Grace Missions was supplying everything that was necessary, not only to keep the surgical block open, but also providing the medications, almost all the medications for the hospital. And we never had to close the operating room for a single day during the 8 years that we worked out of that hospital. In spite of the fact that we went months at a time without reliable electricity, we went a whole year without any water. We had a very small staff of guys. If one of us was sick, we wouldn't be able to operate that day. But for 8 years, not one of us was sick in a land where sickness, of course, is part of life. And in spite of three attacks on the hospital. The only time the surgical block was closed down was after the fourth hospital attack, when the entire hospital was closed down by the provincial health director for 1 month. But it was an amazing and a marvelous testimony of God's faithfulness in providing everything that we needed. Never canceled an operation in all of that time. And it was because the Lord provided in amazing ways. And I could tell stories, and I ought to throw this little vignette in. I remember the only time every time they attacked the hospital, they tried to get into the surgical block. They were stalking their own base hospital about 60 kilometers away. And they would attack Marer periodically to carry off everything they could get. They always tried to get into the operating room. And it was amazing that they were never successful. Some of the stories that patients tell, they were beaten on the doors. They broke in every door in the entire hospital every time. They couldn't get into the surgical block. And the first few times that they broke, first time they raided the hospital, we didn't have grates or anything. It was no different from all the other doors, but they couldn't beat it down. There were some terrified patients on the veranda outside the adjacent patient room right next door to the surgical block, and they couldn't get away. So they were cowering on the veranda while the guerrilla soldiers were going through the hospital, firing their weapons and breaking what they couldn't carry and carrying off whatever they could. And they said they heard them yelling to get into the surgical block, and they heard them beating on it with their weapons and so forth, but they couldn't get in. Now, I found the stories almost impossible to believe because the doors weren't even scarred. But at the same time, I mean, it was just the grace of God that they broke down every door in the hospital, but not the one going into the surgical block. So we always give him praise and thanksgiving for that. Well, the Lord protect us. There was one time when we had all of our surgical gowns and drapes. We'd done a whole day's worth of procedures, and all of the linens were in the laundry room waiting to get washed the next day. And we had enough linens to do about a day and a half worth of surgery. And they were able to steal the linens that were in the laundry room. So we showed up for work, and here the hospital had just gotten attacked at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we had to get everything back in order. They didn't get into the surgical block. The patients came back to the hospital. They said, we want our operations. So we did our regular schedule of operations that day, but first I had to run downtown. A local merchant had bought two big rolls of surgical cloth so we could make our gowns and drapes and so forth with it, and he still had one roll. And so I ran and bought that roll and brought it back, and our tailor was busy making drapes and gowns as fast as we were dirtying them up and doing our cases that day. But we never had to cancel an operation, and that's just a vignette of the Lord's faithfulness in providing for us during that time, very difficult times. But because of that, people began coming from all over the Northern Fork provinces of Mozambique to this little rural hospital to get their operations. And it was a tremendous opportunity for evangelism. Like Dr. Foster, I've always felt like the most important ministry in the hospital is the eternal spiritual ministry. And after the other doctor was recalled to Canada and Grace Missions was the sole supporter of this hospital, we could do whatever we wanted to. Nobody would even think of objecting, and we had evangelistic rounds regularly throughout the week. We prayed with all of our patients in the operating room. We distributed Gospels of John in the clinic, and we'd gather everybody together on Sunday afternoons, all the patients and the staff and their family members, and we'd take them to the main hall of the hospital, and we'd preach the gospel to them. And in 1996, at the peak of our work, 4,000 people heard gospel presentations just at the Sunday evangelistic services, and thousands of scripture portions were given away during the year, and hundreds of Bibles were sold. It was the only place in the entire northern part of the country where you could go and buy a Bible in the surgical block at this hospital, because we staffed it and ran it just like a mission hospital. It had morning devotions and so forth. And this was in a Marxist government hospital where it was against the law even for a pastor to come into the hospital and stand at the foot of the bed of one of his patients, one of his parishioners, and pray out loud. And yet we were boldly doing all of this in a government hospital, and nobody objected because of the circumstances that the Lord had raised, brought to pass for us. And so we just praise the Lord for His kindness and His goodness in delivering me from working in the downtown city hospital and giving us on a platter our own mission hospital, totally refurbished by the Canadian government and then operated for 8 years by Grace Missions. Well, through the medical evangelistic ministry, God saved the key men that came to be our associates in the church planting work later on. I want to give you a thumbnail sketch of one of those men. His name is Arnaldo. 4 to 5 years before we were even sent to Mozambique, Grace Missions began praying consistently that God would raise up a Christian or a Mozambican man who could work as my associate. We could work together in that country, recognizing that it was necessary to be teamed up with a national if we were going to establish an indigenous church and overcome a lot of the cultural barriers that are inherent in missionary work. And the Lord answered that prayer in the form of this young man named Arnaldo the very first day I showed up at Morare. He was presented to me, 26-year-old, nominal Muslim, and the head nurse said, or the head of the hospital said, this is the man that's going to work with you day and night. Every working hour, waking hour that you're in the hospital, he's going to be at your side in the operating room, in the clinic, on rounds, and so forth. Well, neither Arnaldo nor I would ever have known it on that day, but he was a marked man. The Lord's hand was upon him, and in fact, had already been working in his heart 6 months before. Another Christian nurse had been witnessing to him there in the hospital, and she piqued an interest in spiritual things. And when I began distributing Gospels of John, he eagerly took his copy, and I noticed he was reading it at every break during the day. And that went on for a couple of months, and after 2 months, when he was still reading that, I asked him, are you having a hard time getting through the Gospel of John? And he said, oh, no, I've read it 3 or 4 times already, but this is the kind of book you got to keep reading. Well, I was really encouraged at that, and I said, well, listen, you know, there's a whole lot more where that came from, and if you'd like to read the whole Bible, I'd be happy to get together with you, and we can go through it together. And he jumped at the opportunity. And over a period of just a few months, that man was transported from glory unto glory. So the Lord drew him to himself. And he went from being a nominal Muslim to being an ardent Christian, just absolutely in love with the Lord, reading the scriptures continually throughout the day whenever he had a break, witnessing to the patients in the clinic, praying with them unashamedly in the operating room, translating all the evangelistic messages for me. And it got to the point when I'd come in on Sunday afternoon to have these evangelistic services, and I'd walk through each room and I'd call the patients to come hear the word of the Lord. They'd come. They were eager to hear it again, but they said, oh yeah, your associate, Arnaldo, he came in yesterday. And turns out I couldn't find anybody he hadn't already witnessed to, but he was eager to tell people about the Lord. And being the very first man to come to salvation and also the most rapidly growing Christian that I've met in my own experiences in Mozambique, he's always been our best fruit. And when a church was established some years later, he was the natural national leader of that church. And we just thank the Lord. His first year as a Christian, even though he's not nearly as literate as any of us are, he read through the whole Bible in his first year because he had to know what it said. And he had a practice of rereading it every year for quite a few years. Now he's slowed down some on that. But he's very faithful in family devotions. His two oldest children now are boys, and they've both come to salvation and bear real good signs of being truly saved. And his two daughters are also growing up in the Lord. The only problem is his wife. She's a Muslim, as he was, of course, when he married her and when we got to know them. But her father was the leader of the mosque where she grew up. And when they found out that her husband was a Christian, they came to take her away with them and bring them back home. And they spent 3 to 4 weeks there in the home. Actually, it was her mother and her brothers, because her father had died by that time. And they were so impressed with the way this man loved his wife and the way that he cared for her and provided for her, they said, well, you know, we want to take her away, but we could never find anybody as good as you to take care of her. So we're going to let her stay with you. But they gave her stern orders that she was never to go to the church again, and she was never even to be in the house when Arnaldo had family worship. And that was about 10 years ago. And from that day to this, she's never darkened the door of the church, and she always goes out of the house whenever Arnaldo has family devotions or Bible reading or prayers. And that's been a chronic prayer request of ours, and we would ask you to continue to pray for Arnaldo, that the Lord would be pleased to bring his wife to salvation. Well, not only has he been a marvelous brother in Christ, but he also, the hand of the Lord has been upon him in the medical work as well. And I trained him, of course. He was supposed to be with me every hour I was in the hospital, so he was trained to be the instrument tech in the operating room, and he did such a good job. He was excellent. I went on and trained him how to do operations, because that's normal in Africa. In Mozambique, most of the people doing surgery are nurses because they don't have doctors to speak of. And we used to send in his operative reports every year to the Ministry of Health so they would know all the good work he was doing. And in fact, they were very impressed, and he was made given credentials by the Ministry of Health to do any surgical procedure that I'm willing to let him do. And so he's been a great right-hand man, and we really thank the Lord for him. Well, with all of the dramatic events that were taking place in the medical work, people who were coming to salvation, the opportunity to share the gospel with the whole northern four provinces of Mozambique, just staying right where you were because they came to you, and then they would go home, at least with a head knowledge of Jesus Christ. You can imagine how disappointed we were in 1998 when the hospital at Marere was delivered back into the hands of the Catholic Church. Under the terms of the new constitution, all the properties that had been seized by the Marxist government at the time of independence were to be returned to their original owners if they wanted them back. And the Catholic Church in 1998 said that they wanted to have the hospital of Marere back. And so we began making plans to go elsewhere to continue our medical ministry. There wasn't any place in Nampula that we could go to, so we were looking at the rural districts. Well, my wife happened to mention this to somebody, a friend of hers who lived down the street, and she got the word out to everybody. And the townspeople pleaded with us to just build our own medical center right there in Nampula. And a Brazilian architect offered to do all the plans for free. A Portuguese lawyer said he'd handle all the paperwork for free. And the local businessmen's association went out and got an 8-acre piece of property with 150 meters of frontage on the only paved highway that goes all the way through Nampula, the main highway of Mozambique. And the first I knew about any of this, the first I knew anybody knew, was when the Businessmen's Association called me up and said, whose name do we put on the deed for the land that we're giving you for the hospital that you're going to build here in Nampula? And that was news to me. And so I got in touch with Grace Missions, and we felt that the Lord was leading in that way. And so we went ahead and said, okay, we'll see what we can do. And the land was ceded over to us. And the most difficult thing by far was getting the authorization of the Minister of Health to build a private hospital. Even though the Constitution now allows for it, their thinking is still very Marxist, and they don't want to have health in the hands of the private sector. And getting authorization to actually build a hospital, though it was legally, constitutionally permitted, getting authorization was going to be a difficult thing. And it became nearly impossible. Because during the second term that we were on the field, as the central hospital downtown saw all these people walking past their facility to go to this little rural hospital in the bush to get their operations, some of the doctors became very jealous. And all through the second term, they were mounting attempts to close down the hospital, the surgical work at Marere. But they were never successful. It was always a near miss. We could feel the bullets whizzing by our ears. But finally, one of those doctors was promoted to the Ministry of Health in Maputo, and he was actually given the post of being responsible for all the hospitals in the country that get support from foreign organizations. Well, that included the hospital at Marere. We were still working there. It was before the Catholics had taken it over. All of this was coming together at the right time. And he showed up one day and did the first inspection that had ever been conducted at the hospital. And he walked in to the operating room and he says, "What's this? We've got a nurse doing surgery at this hospital? I'm scandalized. I've never heard of such a thing. Well, it's the common practice in Mozambique. And, of course, we've been sending in this guy's operative reports for years, every year. And he says, I'm going back to Maputo, and I'm going to write up the documents, and we're closing down this operating room. You'll get the documents in a few weeks. Well, we began thinking, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to keep this going? And a lot of plans came up. Well, we'll just tell the press about it. We'll get the TV crew to come out and play up the surgical service, and then they'll maybe be afraid to sweep the underpinnings out from under it. But one of the guys on the surgical team during morning devotion says, you know, the Lord's directed my attention to Lamentations 3, 25 and 26, where it says, the Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. It is good that he waits silently for the salvation of the Lord. I think we ought to do nothing and just pray and let the Lord take care of it. And I was inclined the same way, but I appreciated getting that kind of counsel from fellows on the surgical team, these African fellows that had come to salvation just in recent years. And so that's what we did. We just prayed about it every day. And sure enough, about a week later, along came a guy. We were finishing up an operation. I was told by a nurse that came in very excitedly and said, the former minister of health is out here in the waiting room. He wants to talk to you. Well, this was the head man of surgery for all of Mozambique. And this is the first feedback I'd ever gotten about all these documents I kept sending in every year about Arnaldo's operations that he was doing. But he's the guy that had been getting it. And he was training all the nurses who did surgery in Mozambique, and he was overwhelmed at the volume of surgery that this nurse was doing and the kind of results he was getting. So he flew up to Nampula to speak with me personally to find out if he could start rotating all the nurse surgeons through our facility so that they could get the benefit of all this training and all this experience. And I was very happy to tell him I'd be pleased to do that. There's only one problem. We're waiting to be shut down any day now. We're just waiting for the documents to get here. And he said, don't worry about that. I'll take care of it. And so, sure enough, about a week later, we got the documents. The minister, the provincial health director, called me in, and he gave me the documents written from Maputo closing down the surgical service. He says, well, don't you worry. This was sent in the mail 2 weeks ago. It's only now gotten here, but I was in Maputo last week, and I spoke with Dr. Vaz, the head surgeon of Mozambique. He says, no problem. He's already dealt with it. Go right on operating. So we were very thankful for that. But what the fella did, who was our adversary, he just bided his time. And he leapfrogged over the head of the former minister of health and the director of surgery for the country of Mozambique. And he went to the vice minister when he had the opportunity. And he won the vice minister over. I don't know what kind of stories he told him, but he convinced him that they needed to shut down the surgical program at Marere. So a few months later, along comes our adversary again, this time with the vice minister in tow. They get into the operating room, and all of a sudden, he's indignant again. He says, they got a nurse doing surgery here in this very operating room. And I've already written my documents saying that this operating room is to be closed. I looked at the provincial health director who was right beside me, and, you know, you can explain all this. You're the one that's told me it's all taken care of. He didn't say anything. And so finally I said, well, I'd be glad to answer those things, but I'd like to do it in private because the vice minister had his whole entourage with him. So that won't be necessary. I'll go back to Maputo. I'll write my own report to the minister of health. We'll let the minister of health take care of it personally, and he won't be pleased with the report that I'm going to write. So once again, I got on the phone right away to talk to Dr. Vaz. What happened, Dr. Vaz? You said that you had taken care of it. He said, I did take care of it. I don't know what's happened, but I'll go talk to the Minister of Health. And so for the next week, I was calling him every few days, and he said, I still can't get in to see him. He never did get in to see the Minister of Health. But at exactly the same time, unbeknownst to me, a friend of mine was in Maputo. He's an academic surgeon at George Washington University, professor of surgery. He was in Southern Africa on a Fulbright scholarship to give advice to all the surgical facilities in Southern Africa. And he'd been there for several months, and he'd come to our very hospital and visited with me. He was a brother in Christ, and as well as being this academic surgeon. And then he'd left the country. But he had been summoned back to Mozambique by the Minister of Health in order to have an audience with him so he could be thanked for all the services he'd rendered in his previous time in Mozambique. And while he was sitting out there waiting to for his audience with the Minister of Health, he said he saw this document waiting for the Minister of Health's attention, written by the provincial, by the vice minister, saying that they needed to close down the surgical service at Moraire. And he was appalled. You know, this was the surgical service of his good friend, Charles Woodrow, there in Grace Missions. And he immediately changed his whole plans for that meeting with the Minister of Health. And when he came in to see him, he said, you know, I've been all over Southern Africa, and I've seen all these surgical units everywhere, and I want you to know you've got the very best surgical unit in the whole that I've seen right here in your own country, and it's in a little rural hospital up in Nampula, the Hospital of Moraire. And the Minister of Health was so impressed by everything that he had to say, didn't have a clue that this man was a friend of mine, and that he knew about this intrigue that was underfoot. He said, well, you know, I got a trip planned to Nampula in just 2 weeks. So I'm going to go see that hospital. I'll do that first thing. I'll go see this surgical service you're talking about. And so right away, this doctor, Dr. Gelhood, called me on the phone. He said, you must have some great prayers. You're not going to believe what the Lord just did for you. And when he told me, I said, yeah, we do have great prayers, and I can't believe what the Lord has just done. And he said, get ready. In 2 weeks, the Minister of Health is going to be there. Well, I wished I'd just seen a patient the week before in the clinic who I just wished I could call in. We scheduled her for an operation. I wish we could call her in, do her operation, present her to the Minister of Health as one of the reasons why this surgical service needed to be kept open in Mozambique, because she had been operated on at the downtown hospital many years before by a Cuban doctor, had a hysterectomy, and he ended up suturing her vagina and bladder together. So that a defect developed, so that whenever, you know, the kidneys produced urine, they went right into the bladder, from the bladder directly onto her clothing. There was no continence because of the hole that had that he had made between the inadvertently made between the bladder and the vagina. And of course, if you've been around outhouses, you know how they smell so bad. That's because of the bacteria that's infecting the urine that's all around. Well, once you've got this kind of a problem, the urine, the bladder becomes infected, and you walk around smelling like an outhouse, and you're a social recluse. Well, she was a member of a family with some standing, and so they contracted with the most widely renowned surgeon there in the north, an Indian doctor, and he operated on her twice at the Central Hospital and couldn't correct the fistula, couldn't correct the problem. So after three failed operations, she was afraid to have anything else done there. She flew to Maputo and contracted with the leading gynecologist in the country to try to get the problem fixed, but he wouldn't operate on her. He just gave her antibiotics for 6 months. Of course, that's not going to solve the problem. And so she lived in Maputo with relatives taking antibiotics for 6 months and finally gave up, came back to Nampula and lived as a social recluse for several years until somebody told her, well, you know, they do these operations out at the Hospital of Moraire. Why don't you go out there? And she had gone out there, and I'd seen her just either that week or the week before, scheduled her for an operation, and I wanted to bring her in and do her so we could present her to the Minister of Health. But the problem was she was scheduled for 2 months down the road. And in Mozambique, people don't have telephones, and they don't even have addresses for their huts. We didn't know how to get hold of her, and I thought it was just a lost opportunity. But lo and behold, 8 days before the Minister of Health showed up, we drove up to the hospital, and who should be waiting for us on the steps of the hospital but the fistula patient. She had her bags packed. She said, I don't want to wait 2 months for my operation. I want to get operated on today. And I said, well, did you eat breakfast? And she said, no. And I said, okay, you're going to the operating room. And we took her straight to the OR. And but once we got inside the operating room, turns out she was terrified after three failed operations. She had a lot of bad experiences behind her. And the first thing we had to do was just do a little exam to look at the fistula so we could plan the operation. I did it in the clinic, no problem. But up there, we were in the operating room, and she was terrified. And the whole surgical team had to pile on top of her and pin her down just so I could get a look at what we were going to have to operate on. And then when we had to put a catheter in her bladder, a painless procedure, she was hysterical again, and we all had to pile on and hold her down, and you'd have thought we were playing a rugby match or something on the OR table. And it was the same way with the spinal anesthetic, and she was so terrified, we all wondered, what in the world is this lady doing on our operating room table? How does she have the courage to come in to get this operation in the first place, let alone coming in 2 months early? But we knew the answer to that. We knew the Lord's hand was working in all of this, and we knew the operation was going to come out fine. Even though I've had some of these fishes I've operated on 7 times before I could get them fixed. But we knew this was going to come out right the first time, and sure enough, it just went perfectly. You have to leave the catheter in the bladder for 7 days after these operations so that the bladder doesn't distend with urine while the incisions are healing. And so for 7 days, she lay in the hospital bed. Didn't lose a drop of urine, but it was all coming out through the catheter. Finally, the 7th day, we pulled out the catheter to see what would happen. And sure enough, her bladder distended, no incontinence, no urine leaking. The hole had healed completely. And she was finally, when she had the urge, she was able to void normally for the first time in many years. And she was profoundly grateful and ready to be discharged. But we said, no, you're going to stay one more day. We've got an important visitor we want you to meet. And the next day, sure enough, 7:30 in the morning, very first stop of the Minister of Health, he came to the Hospital of Moreira with a whole big entourage of dignitaries. And they spent 30 minutes in the surgical block. We presented all photographs of all the operations that we'd done and all of our statistics on the work that we'd been doing for 8 years. And at the end of it all, we brought in our fistula patient and the effect. She gave her a little testimony. And the effect was just what we had prayed for. The Minister of Health invited me out to have dinner with him that evening with a few other doctors in the area. And that evening when I showed up, he took me aside and said, I know you're having a lot of trouble from the Central Hospital. What can I do to help you? And I said, well, I'd really appreciate 2 things. I'd like to have a written document from the Ministry of Health authorizing our nurse to do surgery. He said, no problem, I'll do it. So the second thing is Grace Missions wants to build a surgical center right here in Nampula, and we're going to have your approval. He said, you've got it. And so in a couple of months, he prepared both of those documents, and we had them. And so that's how the Lord opened the way for us to be able to begin work on the Mission Hospital. And the whole third term has been devoted to a lot of different things, but in the medical work, I haven't been doing surgery. We've been doing construction on this hospital. It's a lot slower in Mozambique than I ever dreamed it would be. I mean, you have to think in slow motion in Mozambique. You have to sleep in slow motion in Mozambique. But even allowing for all of that, I never realized how big a job it was going to be just doing the simplest things in terms of getting things built. But we do have the foundations in for the hospital, and the 2 sanitation blocks are built, and the evangelistic pavilion is up, and we've got this 8-acre site all built up and looking very nice. And we're looking forward to getting on with the medical work. I'd like to ask that you would pray 2 requests with regard to the medical work. The first one would be that God would continue to provide the funds to get it finished. And the second one would be that the Lord would raise up 2 general surgeons to come work and a family practitioner, and after listening to Dr. Foster, I realized we better ask for an anesthesiologist because the government's likely to insist on that. We've always done our own anesthesia, but we better throw in an anesthesiologist for that. So if you'd be praying for those things, we'd appreciate it. I want to speak briefly about the church work, and I'm going to have to be very brief there because the time is, well, maybe the time is passing. Yeah, it is. But I know I've dropped a tidbit about being in jail, and I've got to give the explanation for that. The church work has been just as remarkable as the medical work. We've had our wonderful highs when we see spiritual breakthroughs taking place, such as I spoke about with regard to Arnaldo. And then we've had our times of deep disappointment and discouragement as we've seen real difficulties as well. And difficult times, including the night that I spent in jail last August, until these false accusations could be investigated and discarded. But basically, the church work got underway right at the end of our first term. 9 fellows who had responded to the hospital evangelistic ministry and had been discipled for 1 to 2 years and had gotten involved in different local churches decided that they wanted to establish a church that would function along the lines of the Bible because they saw discrepancies in the practice and the teaching of the churches that they had become members of. And so we helped them get this church going. And then in the second term, that was our top priority, was to see this church established on a strong biblical base. And in fact, during the third term, the government registered our church, which was a wonderful thing. I know excellent Christian organizations that had been seeking to get their churches registered for 16 years unsuccessfully. And we put in our application to be registered, too, as soon as we qualified, and we weren't surprised that they turned us down. But lo and behold, a few months later, they called up and they said, we're registering your church, and we're going to send a guy up there in a week to have that done, and you need to get a big ceremony and a reception organized for that. And the great advantage of being registered as a church is that you're then recognized by the government as a legitimate Christian or a legitimate religious enterprise, which therefore means you can bring missionaries into the country, and the government will allow them to live and work there as long as you're sponsoring them. So we've been given that great privilege, and we're looking forward to the Lord raising up a church planting missionary, and that's what we want you to pray for with the church work, that the Lord would raise up a church planting missionary who could give the proper attention to the men who are in the church and seeking to establish this church on a good biblical basis. So that's what we'd like to see. Well, along the way, we've tried to adhere to biblical principles within the church, and we've had four principles that have been particularly difficult to uphold in our congregation. One of them is biblical leadership. We're committed to elders who are qualified according to the biblical qualifications given in Titus 1, 1 Timothy 3. Unfortunately, that means we have no elders in our church. Other churches have elders, but we don't have elders because we're holding to the biblical requirements. And that has been a source of some dissatisfaction, at least on the part of one man who is a provisional leader, was a provisional leader with Arnaldo and myself, but he really wanted to be an elder. The second thing was that we believe in regenerate membership. For a person to be a member of the church, we don't accept them just on the profession of faith. We'll baptize them on a profession of faith. But to become a church member, we want to see signs of spiritual rebirth. We want to see evidence that they love the Lord, that they've experienced a change in their life, and that they are seeking to grow in Christ. And some of our people, particularly this third leader in the church, couldn't understand why we wanted that. Now we understand why he couldn't understand that, because we find out that he has a different heart. The third thing is we uphold church discipline. And when people sin in egregious ways and demonstrate that they don't have a plan to change their behavior and conduct after being admonished by the church, then we do exercise church discipline. And then the fourth area that's been controversial is that we limit the mission's support of any church activity to only 50%. The church has to provide 50%, and we'll provide 50%. But our church budget's only $200 a year. Grace Missions could supply all of that and more without even feeling it, and the people realize that. And no matter how much we try to explain, for some people it's hard to understand. Why don't you just give us a lot of money and let us build our church buildings and get on with our program? Why do we have to move along at the rate of us providing 50%? But we want them to not become dependent on the missionary or to become dependent on a mission organization. We want them to look to God and also to their own sweat and labor and their own pocketbooks for these things. Well, Matthew 5, 11 and 12 says, blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. And Arnaldo and I have found out what it is to be so blessed. Because in time, our third leader, even though he always went along with this, we never had a clue that these things rubbed him the wrong way. But in time, the third leader became very embittered about how the church's progress was being held up by these four requirements that kept us from having the same status as other churches with elders and with lots of members and with big projects going on funded from overseas. And without the discouragement of church discipline, he decided he was going to have to take things in his own hand and correct the situation. And his way of doing that was to begin sowing scandalous stories against Arnaldo and myself for the purpose of getting me expelled from the country and Arnaldo expelled from the church. About Arnaldo, he said he's got a second wife in secret. He's practices drunken debauchery, and he's teaching his own sons how to engage in sexual immorality and drunkenness, which are total fabrications. About me, he said that the church had received $10,000 from the mission, and I diverted it for other purposes, that the mission had sent a sea container full of relief aid for the church, and I'd burned it up rather than give it to them, and that another container had been sent full of bicycles and Christian literature, and Arnaldo and I sold it on the black market and divided the income up between the two of us. And supposedly he knew all of this because he was the third leader in the church, and he was going to blow our cover. And these stories were disseminated not only amongst certain people in the church that he could trust to keep it quiet, but also widely disseminated amongst the other church leaders in the community and, of course, the civil authorities. And nobody ever asked for any evidence about any of this, but after repeatedly meeting with the civil authorities, they forwarded a letter from him to the governor outlining all of these atrocities for the purpose of having me expelled from the country. And I've accompanied that process with other expatriates who've been given 24 hours from the government to get out of the country. And, of course, all you can do is get your ticket and get on the plane. Everything else becomes the government's property. And that was this man's plan. He was planning to get rid of me and then expel Arnaldo and basically inherit everything that Grace Missions had in the country. Well, thankfully, the only person that ever asked for any investigation, any evidence, was the governor, the last stop before being expelled. And he said, I'm not going to do this without having some evidence. And he instructed the provincial director of religious affairs to look into it. And so he called me in, and that's the first time I was ever had an inkling that our trusted associate could even think of such things, let alone execute a plan over several months' duration toward bringing that to pass. Well, the whole thing rapidly fell apart because there wasn't a shred of evidence for it, but unfortunately the dirty stories had been disseminated far and wide. And I spoke to our lawyers mainly because I was concerned for a period of time that I might get a slip any day, being told, 24 hours, get out of the country. And so I was speaking with lawyers, what can we do about this? And the lawyer said, well, the only thing you can do is sue the man for libel, take him to court, have him proven convicted of libel. He'll go to prison, and then the court will send out official documents to the governor's office and everywhere else saying to disregard everything you've heard from this man. Well, that would clear my name, but of course it would drag the name of Christ through the dirt and through the mud to take something like that to court. So we didn't, of course, do that. And thankfully, over a period of time, we weathered that trial, and things came back to normal. And in a very deliberate and careful proceeding, we did expel the man over a 12-month period of time. We had to go slow, give him lots of time for repentance, or people would have thought it was just a vindictive thing. But he was expelled from the church. And then 3 hours last August, 3 hours before I was supposed to leave the country, the fellow went to the chief of police in the city with the same made-up story and said, the guy's got the $10,000 in his pocket. He's going to leave the country tonight, which is true. I was about to leave. And if you don't go arrest him and put him in jail, he'll be gone tomorrow. And so to my amazement, two police showed up with our former third leader in the church with a warrant for my arrest and took me down to the police station and booked me and put me in jail. And but thankfully, once we got to the police station, of course, guys recognized me. And they realized we're bringing in the Christian missionary doctor who's building our surgical center out on the edge of town. What's going on here? And but the chief of police had already gone home for the day, so they had to wait till the next morning. So I spent the night in jail, and but they were very deferring to me. They were very polite and considerate. And when he came in, the very first thing he did was do a quick investigation. And of course, by that time, our associate had shown up with all the documents, legal documents as well, verifying that this had all been investigated and the man had already been dealt with and disciplined by the church. And he immediately released me and went out and arrested the fellow for conning the police and put him in jail. And then he again filled out charges on defamation of character and wanted me to sign it to take the guy to court because he was really angry that this man had played upon his gullibility. But again, we didn't want to take the fellow to court because of what it would do for the name of Christ. He professes to be a Christian. He calls himself a pastor. And we didn't want to bring all of this to the attention of everybody. And so we didn't do it. And I went on home. I had to cancel the meetings that I had in Maputo with the customs officials, the adjutant to the national director of customs, in terms of meetings about getting supplies imported for the hospital. Had to cancel a couple of preaching engagements in South Africa because I was in jail. But finally I left. And a few weeks after I left, my colleague said that some medical associates of mine showed up at his house wanting to know if it was true what they were hearing. They'd heard from the community that I had been arrested. The reason nobody saw me around Maputo anymore, or Nampula these days, was because I'd been arrested crossing the border by the police, and I was in prison in Maputo because of sex crimes. And so he contacted our church leaders and said, you know, are these stories really going around? And they said, yeah, that's what everybody is saying now. Well, we know where these stories come from. And so our other prayer request with regard to the church planting work is that you would pray that God would bind this man and perhaps expose him in a way that will set us free from this. Now, I want to say that I'll have to finish up with this. This is not the first time, of course, that our attempts have been made to terminate our ministry. You already have heard that permission to build the mission hospital actually resulted from strenuous efforts to close down the medical work that ascended all the way to the Minister of Health before finally being overturned. And behind these prodigious and destructive labors by men who ought to be allies, we cannot help but see the sinister and powerful hand of the evil one at work. A culture that constantly calls upon the devil for his involvement in everyday affairs of life, from healing their diseases to getting vengeance on their enemies to finding lost articles and so forth, is a culture that God may judge by giving Satan the powerful role that they want for him in their society. And I do believe that Satan has been given much power in Mozambique, and we need the protection that's afforded by prayer. And we don't assume that our long-term presence in Mozambique is assured simply because we know the Lord has clearly called us there. Because of 14 consecutive missionary families known to us and sent to northern Mozambique between 1960 and 1995, 11 were forced to terminate their ministries prematurely, often after only one term. 6 were expelled, 2 by the government, and 4 by adversaries raised up within the churches that they served. 2 more left after one term when they realized that opposition within the churches that they were seeking to help was such that they were headed to the same end. One ministry was ended by the death of the missionary. It was an outstanding ministry, about the best one that we've seen in Nampula. But this man died after a few years in an automobile accident. Another excellent ministry was terminated by a disability in the family that required long-term treatment outside the country. One family left suddenly without any explanation. We don't know what was going on there. For 25 years, during that interval from 1960 to 1995, there were no missionaries at all in the north. And of the 12 families who re-entered the field back between 1985 and 1995, only our family and 2 others have survived to the present. And of these 3 families, 2 of us have weathered serious attempts at our expulsion. So I think the evil one is using all of his power to eject those who've invaded his domain in Christ's name. And some of those people who have been removed were the very best missionaries, which might explain why they became the targets for elimination. One went on to become the international director of his mission. And so despite our clear calling and several divine deliverances so far, we don't imagine that we're indestructible in this struggle. In any conflict, there are casualties even on the winning side, as we've already seen in northern Mozambique. Satan has been given much authority in our region, and we need your prayers if we're going to long survive his continued attacks. And so I just hope that brings home the gravity. We can sort of laugh about being thrown in jail on these hokey charges and so forth, but we mustn't take it too lightly. The evil one has thrown practically everybody out. It's a revolving door for missionaries in Mozambique. We've been there 14 years now. We are thankful and grateful to God for that longevity. But we keep wondering when we're going to get hit by that bullet. And we do believe it's only by the grace of God that we've survived so far. And we want to encourage you to be praying for us in that regard. Well, I'm going to have to end here. The most exciting ministry has been what's developed in the third term, this opportunity to witness, or not to witness, but to minister to the entire church of Mozambique through these annual conferences and through the nationwide Christian literature distribution program. But I'll just have to save that perhaps for another visit. I do want to get back to Community Bible Church with my whole family and spend a week here so we can visit and renew friendships. But that's a thumbnail sketch of our field. And again, you've got prayer requests. Please pray that the Lord will raise up the funds to finish the hospital, that he'll raise up the medical people we need for the hospital, that he will bind the power of the evil one, and that he will provide a church planting missionary to work with us in the church planting work in Nampula. Those are our prayer requests. Thank you very much for this time. Mm-hmm.